Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer in their lifetime, many more than men. Fewer than 1% of men are diagnosed with the disease, but their odds for survival are much worse. The issue got some traction last week when superstar Beyoncé Knowles' father, Matthew Knowles, revealed his own breast cancer diagnosis on national television. Dr. Payal Shah is an assistant professor of medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. She is an oncologist and who studies breast cancer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why are the outcomes worse for men than women?
That's a great question, and I think one of the main contributing reasons is that male breast cancer is often diagnosed at a later stage than breast cancer in women. And part of the reason is just that it's not as well known that men can develop breast cancer in the first place. I think there's a lot of attention on breast cancer for women. You see during October Breast Cancer Awareness Month, there's an emphasis on our moms, our sisters, our wives, on pink. So I think many men don't know that they can develop breast cancer, and so there's not as much attention to subtle symptoms that might develop.
I want to invite our listeners, if you have a question about this important issue, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about the incidence of breast cancer in men. My guest is Dr. Payal Shah. She's assistant professor of medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. She is an oncologist who studies breast cancer. You said the subtle signs of breast cancer. Is it different? Does it present differently in men?
Not necessarily. The main symptoms of breast cancer that can present, if breast cancer is symptomatic, can be a lump in the breast, nipple discharge, especially bloody nipple discharge, changes in the skin around the breast, changes in the nipple, for example, retraction or pulling in of the nipple. It's just that I think for women who are aware of the risk of breast cancer, we see a change in the breast, and women are more likely to bring it to their gynecologist or their primary care provider, whereas men, in part because there's not as much of a focus on male breast cancer, men don't necessarily think to immediately bring it to medical attention. It often takes a little bit more time.
We often hear about the breast cancer gene.
Yes.
Is there one in men? I mean, is it the same thing for men, or can it be?
Yes. So BRCA1 and BRCA2, especially BRCA2, are really the main genes that we think about when we think about male breast cancer. So BRCA1 and BRCA2 are genes that everyone has, and they normally work to help repair mistakes that normally happen in DNA. Mm-hmm. And some individuals inherit a version of the gene that doesn't work as well, and that is what can increase the risk for certain cancers, including male breast cancer and others.
Is the gene different in men than it is in women?
No, actually, okay. That's a great question, and it's a common misunderstanding. I think it's a relatively common misunderstanding that if you're a male with a BRCA mutation, you can't pass it on to your children. Hmm. That's actually not correct. An individual can inherit a faulty copy of BRCA1 or BRCA2 from either mom or dad, and a male carrier of a BRCA mutation can still pass it on to his children. There's a 50% chance that that will happen.
So then this is something that if you have the history of this in your family, it's certainly something that you mentioned to your physician.
Absolutely. But I think that's another thing where there's not as much awareness.
Yeah.
So there are some men who have a family history of breast and ovarian cancer, but they don't think to mention it to their doctors because they know they can't get ovarian cancer and they think that they can't get breast cancer as men. But certainly a family history of breast, ovarian, and other cancers can be a major clue that you have a mutation in one of these genes, and it can still put men at risk for breast cancer and other cancers, and men can pass the gene down the same way as women. So it is very important, and one of the benefits of having people talk about male breast cancer is that more men may go to their physicians to talk about their family histories.
So it's not even a routine question that physicians ask their male patients?
Yeah, so a family history in general of
cancer,
of heart issues, is part of is one of the main questions that is asked by primary care physicians. I think that you know, delving into in depth how many first, second, and third degree relatives had what cancers at what ages, and is there any, for example, Ashkenazi Jewish heritage? Those are some of the more specific questions that clue us into individuals maybe having one of these gene mutations, but those are, you're absolutely right, that they're not as frequently asked by primary care providers, but I think as there's a growing awareness of BRCA1, BRCA2, other genes and genetically linked cancer in general, primary care providers and internists are asking some of these questions with increasing frequency.
Yeah, is this just an issue for educating the public, or are you also trying to educate your colleagues, your peers?
Yeah, you're absolutely right that it's education all around. It's education for patients, and it is certainly education for doctors as well. There was one study that was published a few years ago that cited somewhere like 19% of primary care physicians are obtaining a family history that assesses for BRCA1 and BRCA2 risk, kind of with all of the questions that we would recommend. So there's education all around.
I know it's kind of been a mixed bag over time about how or whether self-examinations by women are effective or not because of the density of breasts and that kind of thing. It varies so widely.
Yeah.
Is that different for men who don't have the same density issues?
That's a great question. And I think, you know, the way that we think about self-breast exams is that what's really important, I think, for men and women is self-awareness, kind of breast awareness. So I wouldn't say there's a difference in terms of how this translates for men as compared with women just based on the density. But I would say that for men, because they are not undergoing, you know, annual or biannual mammograms, self-awareness is somewhat even more important.
Does the treatment for breast cancer differ for men than women? Is it different for men than women?
Actually, no, not really. So what we know about the treatment of male breast cancer, you know, most of our clinical trials really focused on breast cancer in women. And so the management of men with breast cancer is pretty similar to the management of women with breast cancer, with a few key differences. So in terms of genetic testing, first of all, any male with breast cancer should get genetic testing. In terms of surgery, women with breast cancer sometimes undergo mastectomy, sometimes lumpectomy, which is just removal of the area with cancer, whereas most men with breast cancer have a mastectomy up front. In terms of picking, if they're going to be treated with anti-estrogen therapy, we tend to lean towards one choice more than another in men. But otherwise, really, decisions about surgery, radiation, treatments including chemotherapy, they're pretty much similar for men as for women.
I usually talk about the gender issue regarding research in terms of not enough women are included in studies.
Yeah.
When it comes to breast cancer research, are enough men included in the studies?
You know, I think it's something that more and more is being recognized. You know, even when we write our inclusion criteria for clinical protocols, historically, it would say something like women over the age of 18, and I think more and more we're modifying that to say, you know, adults over the age of 18. So it's male breast cancer is just not common, so it would be very hard to conduct a clinical trial, like a therapeutic clinical trial, solely in men, but certainly we're moving towards including them more.
One of the things we're learning about cancer, obviously you know this, is that there's so many different kinds, and there's so many, just in the realm of breast cancer alone, and how you treat it is so different depending on the person. I had a friend who had triple negative. I mean, I didn't even know what that meant until she explained it to me. And I'm just wondering, are there that many different kinds of breast cancer in men?
There are. There are the same subtypes of breast cancer in men as in women, and you're absolutely right. It is getting more in-depth as the years go by. You know, 5 years ago, even the way that we were developing our treatments were, does this patient have, as you said, triple negative, meaning breast cancer that's not using hormones or a protein called HER2 kind of as food to grow? Or does a patient have hormone receptor positive breast cancer where it's really relying on the hormones to grow? Or, you know, is a person's cancer relying on the HER2 protein to grow? Those were basically the three major subtypes of breast cancer that we thought about and that we continue to think about. But now, even just over the last 5 years, we're learning more about breast cancer features that can impact treatment. For example, for patients who have advanced breast cancer, we now look for, you know, if it's triple negative, we look for a protein called PD-L1 on the surface that'll tell us about whether or not immunotherapy is an option. We look for patients who have hormone receptor positive breast cancer, we look for a gene called PIK3CA to tell us if, you know, there's another targeted drug that is an option. And actually, in 2018, we had the first two FDA approvals for patients who have BRCA-related metastatic breast cancer for a category of drugs, of targeted therapies called PARP inhibitors. And those are drugs that really take advantage of the specific deficiency that comes with having a BRCA mutation in the tumor.
Is there a takeaway from the fact that so many more women do get breast cancer than men? Is there something, what is it physiologically, do we know why that is?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think there's many reasons, some of which we certainly don't understand. I think that there are hormonal drivers of breast cancer. For example, the majority of breast cancer uses estrogen and or progesterone to grow, and those are hormones that are generally found at higher levels in women than in men. I think that's one main reason. I think certainly there's a lot more to the story that we just don't understand.
Well, Dr. Payal Shah, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Payal Shah, Assistant Professor of Medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. She's an oncologist who studies breast cancer. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I hope I didn't butcher your first name.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The president of France wants to extend the option of in vitro fertilization to single women, regardless of sexual orientation. That would lift a current restriction on any women to get free treatments such as in vitro and access to sperm donation. That, of course, is free. That is in France. Dr. Brooke Rossi is a reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist at Ohio Reproductive Medicine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Let's talk about how in vitro fertilization works. It's been around for how long now?
So it's been around for about 40 years, and in vitro fertilization essentially means that the egg and the sperm are fertilized in the laboratory. So briefly, what happens is a woman will undergo ovarian stimulation, which means that we get her ovaries to make several eggs all at once, and she takes hormonal injections and has her ovaries monitored for about 7 to 10 days. Then she undergoes a procedure called an egg retrieval, where we take the eggs from her ovaries, and then we put them with sperm in the laboratory, and we create embryos. So that fertilized egg is called an embryo. Routinely now it grows for about 5 days in the laboratory, and then the patient then undergoes an embryo transfer, in which the embryo is then placed back into the uterus through the cervix.
It's always been expensive, right?
It is. I mean, it is one of the more expensive treatments that we have available. depending on sort of what procedures a patient needs, it can be in the ballpark of about $10,000 to $15,000.
A pop.
Yeah, per cycle. Now, fortunately, now many patients will go through a procedure and have extra embryos, like embryos that are good quality that they might not be using immediately. They can save those and they can freeze them. And then in the future, a patient can undergo a frozen embryo transfer, which is at a much lower cost, probably about $3,000.
This is a big ethical issue in France. What are the ethical issues in the United States?
I think the United States is a little bit different than parts of Europe, you can imagine. And so we think about the ethical issues, really what the patient thinks, you know, is right for them. We do have some patients who believe that life starts with fertilization, and so they have strong beliefs about whether they would or not discard embryos that they would use. People have different beliefs about whether an embryo should undergo genetic testing or not. And I think to some degree, maybe there's thoughts about who should or shouldn't have this procedure done. But in general, I think in the United States, we're much more open about considering different treatments for all patients.
What are the main factors when it comes to considering in vitro fertilization? Obviously, the issue is that the sperm is that you need sperm to do it.
Correct.
That's the problem.
Right. So I would say some of the main issues that people are having that require in vitro fertilization would be if the egg and the sperm routinely meet in the fallopian tube. So if a woman has tubal factor infertility where her tube doesn't function, that's one reason why people may do in vitro fertilization.
So there may be a sperm available, but
right, but maybe the egg and the sperm can't get to the same place at the same time.
Right.
The next is if there is very poor sperm quality. So if there aren't enough sperm or if the sperm aren't moving properly, that's another big indication for IVF. And then we have a lot of other patients who consider IVF because other less invasive treatments have failed. Sometimes IVF is used for patients who have endometriosis, polycystic ovary syndrome. Sometimes there's another group of patients who may come to us who don't have infertility but have had a young child die from a hereditary disease they didn't know that they had.
Okay.
And that can we have to use the technology of IVF to do genetic testing of their embryo so they can have a healthy child. Sometimes same-sex men who are in a relationship come to us to have a child together with the use of an egg donor and a sperm and a gestational carrier.
What are the risks associated with in vitro fertilization?
When we think about the risks of IVF, we want to think about sort of what are the risks to the children that are born from IVF, and then what are the risks to the women who are undergoing the procedure. Probably the biggest risk that the children born can undergo is prematurity, which is why we really are, as a field, trying to reduce the risk of twins that are born from IVF.
Because there's a higher incidence of multiple births.
Yeah.
So that's going to increase the incidence of prematurity.
Correct.
Okay.
So currently, probably about 30% of babies born from IVF are part of a set of twins, very rarely triplets. And so there is a movement in our field to try to make sure that when we're doing that embryo transfer, putting that embryo back in, that we're really putting just one, because that drastically lowers our risk of twins, and then any pregnancy-associated complications like prematurity, and then other risks to the parent, to the mom, like high blood pressure in pregnancy, gestational diabetes, that sort of thing. There is a slightly higher risk of birth defects among babies born from IVF as well. The baseline risk of birth defects in this country is probably about 3 to 4%, and maybe about 5 or 6% with IVF. Some of those larger studies have demonstrated that risk may be more related to infertility, such that the people who are taking part in IVF have infertility, and that increases the risk of having a child with birth defects rather than the IVF itself. But that is something that we always talk to our patients about.
Are there particular birth defects that are more prominent or more prevalent than others associated with this?
Yeah, and there are some genetic birth defects called imprinting disorders that may be more common with IVF. And then otherwise, it's just kind of general birth defects as well.
Runs the gamut.
Yeah, and then when we think about risks to women, we're always thinking, what are the medical risks of the procedure? There is a probably 1 to 2% risk of ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. We over the years have gotten much better
at where it won't stop producing eggs, or
almost like they have an over response, and sometimes they can have complications from that. But again, over the years we've gotten much better at understanding how to manage that and how to prevent that. There's the actual procedure of retrieving the eggs is relatively safe. There's large studies show there's a less than 1% risk of having bleeding or infection or another organ damage during that process. And then one of the other big questions that people always have is, you know, do these procedures cause an increased risk of ovarian cancer or breast cancer or endometrial cancer in the future? Most of the studies do show that it's safe. It gets complicated to look at these large population studies. One, we only have about 30 years of data, right? Because IVF's only been around about 30 or 40 years. So those women now are currently in their 70s. And there are some confounding variables, like women with polycystic ovary syndrome are already at a greater risk for endometrial cancer. So you don't know if it was their disease that caused them infertility that then was related to the treatment or if it, whether it was the treatment itself. So we're still trying to understand that.
Does age play a role in any of this?
Age is the major determinant of success with in vitro fertilization.
Younger the better?
To some degree, yes. We see that the highest pregnancy rates are in women who are less than 35 and that you know, in women less than 35, the chance of having a baby with in vitro fertilization is probably about 50%. If a woman who's 42 or 43 undergoes IVF, her chance may be more like 5%.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about in vitro fertilization. My guest is Dr. Brooke Rossi. She's a reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist at Ohio Reproductive Medicine. If you have a question for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What are the ethics of that? If you've somebody comes to you and they're over the age of 42 or 43 and they want to do in vitro fertilization, what is your conversation like?
Well, I would say that
is it rare
general,
for one thing? Is it?
It's you know I would.
I guess I should ask that first.
When we look at the national data, most women undergoing IVF are less than 35.
Okay.
I know there's kind of a stereotype that everyone showing up for IVF is, you know, put off having kids into their 40s, but that's not really what it is.
It's
most of our patients
issues.
Are young.
Yeah.
Right. Now, we do have some women who are in their 40s or maybe even in their early 50s. And the American Society for Reproductive Medicine has put out practice guidelines and committee opinions from our ethics committees talking about that it is reasonable to consider helping women in their 40s have children. They often will meet with maternal fetal medicine specialists to make sure that they understand the risks of having a pregnancy in their 40s. They will often have an extensive evaluation before they get pregnant to make sure that they are healthy enough to carry a pregnancy.
There are the other issues of the multiple births. We talked about that a little bit already, but I wanted to get into kind of the octomom, you know, eight is enough for...
I think that's important to recognize that most, you know, although we do have a lot of twins, like I said, about 30% of babies born from IVF are twins. The risk of triplets is very low right now with IVF, and that is really what we're trying to avoid. And so, you know, I think that we all understand that situations like octomom was definitely an outlier and a rarity in our field. And then the other issue is that some of the triplets and quadruplets we may see, or even twins for that matter, are actually not from in vitro fertilization. They can be from a less invasive treatment where we give women shots of hormones and then put the sperm into the uterus with an intrauterine insemination. So John and Kate plus eight was actually not in vitro fertilization.
Okay.
It was a different treatment. And that other treatment, we actually try to avoid quite a bit because we know that it gives us a higher risk of triplets than in vitro fertilization.
And that's something that's happening even before inception. I mean, it's created the circumstances
right.
for
so,
it.
Correct. So when we're doing some of our treatments where women are taking fertility shots and doing insemination, sometimes it's hard to predict how many eggs their ovaries will release and how many of those embryos will fertilize and be created. When we're doing in vitro fertilization, we make a conscious decision to just put one fertilized egg into her uterus. Therefore, we know that her risk of twins is probably less than 1%.
Just like it would be anyway.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
And then what have been the biggest breakthroughs? You said that in vitro fertilization has been around for 40 years.
Yeah.
What have been some of the turning points in that?
It's a pleasure every day to work in this field because it's so interesting and we can help so many patients. One of the biggest I would say developments happened probably in the 1990s, and it was a procedure called ICSI, which stands for intracytoplasmic sperm injection. And that allows us to fertilize eggs when the sperm has very poor quality. And so that was a big development in our field in the 90s. I would say another big development has been the advent of pre-implantation genetic testing, where we can create embryos and then test the embryos before they're put back into the woman's uterus.
What do you test for?
Well, that's what I was kind of mentioning earlier. So sometimes couples who don't have infertility will have a child. The child may be diagnosed with a fatal, mm-hmm. you know, childhood disease, and neither the man nor the woman knew that they carried that disease. And so we can actually make what they call a probe, and we can take cells from the embryo and look for that disease in the embryo and know whether that embryo is going to have that disease or not. So that's definitely been an advent as well. And I would say one of the other more recent things that have been going on is our ability to freeze eggs. So that allows us to, you know, for patients who have ethical issues where they don't want to create a lot of embryos, we can just fertilize a certain amount of eggs and freeze the rest. Or for cancer patients who are facing treatment that may affect their fertility, we can freeze their eggs before they undergo their treatment. Or even for women who are interested in, you know, if they don't have a partner and they know they want a kid in the future, they may freeze their eggs, you know, when they're early 30s to try to make sure they can have a kid down the road.
It's sometimes surprising when you hear about people who, decide to have children later in life, that they don't immediately go to a fertility expert about it, just assuming that it's going to be harder. What kind of questions should people ask themselves and maybe their OBGYN going forward? And then you hear about these years-long struggles to have children.
Right.
And you wonder, is there a cut to the chase moment?
Well, currently, the recommendations are that if a woman is healthy and having regular cycles and she's less than 35, it may be reasonable for her to try for a year before seeking any sort of assistance from her OBGYN or from an infertility specialist. If a woman is more than 35 and she has tried for more than 6 months, she should either talk with her OBGYN or with an infertility specialist. Now, that if something else has coming up, like if, you know, they know there's been a problem where the man had cancer as a child or the woman's not having regular cycles, then they should not wait to see their doctor. They should come see us right away.
If they already know.
Right.
And as far as finding the right specialist, what are your recommendations? People are listening from all over the country.
Right.
I mean, they may not be here.
Right. I think in general, different patients like different types of doctors. I think it's very important that a patient know that their doctor listens to them, that they're doing current treatment, that their IVF laboratory is a good one, and that they're just listening to them and really looking at their whole picture and their whole history when they meet with them.
Can women, so when you talk about women freezing eggs to have children later in life, that means you're freezing an egg from a younger self.
Correct.
And you may have stopped producing eggs, and you can still have in vitro fertilization.
Correct. So we know that, as we said before, the biggest determinant of success with in vitro fertilization is the age of the egg. So we know that if a woman, let's say she freezes eggs when she's 30 years old, and then she may choose at the age of 39 to use them, she should have the chance of getting pregnant that she did when she was 30. And other things, like her risk of miscarriage, would be that of a 30-year-old, not of a 39-year-old.
Even though it's a 39-year-old body?
Well, other risk factors. So like pregnancy risk factors are that of the age of the woman who's
carrying
the pregnancy.
Okay.
But miscarriage, genetic issues, that's all related to the age of the egg.
And as far as the cost to freeze, what's that like?
It depends from place to place. I would say in Ohio, probably about 30% of our patients have infertility treatment coverage. However, many of them don't. Even those women who have treatment for infertility coverage may not have coverage for egg freezing. Mm-hmm. It can be in the ballpark of probably, depending where you go, $5,000 to $12,000, depending.
And what's the trickiest stage of the whole process?
It's really, I mean, I think the emotional part of this is hardest for most patients. It's actually one of the main reasons why people stop treatment. Sometimes it's not even cost. It's just that it's a tremendously stressful time.
Do you have recommend counseling during that time?
We do. We have some counselors that we use in the community. I also am a big proponent of women kind of seeking help from other patients. So there are some support groups locally. I've had a lot of patients also get support from people online, different Facebook groups, maybe people that they never meet, but they just talk about things. They help each other out. They support each other. I think it's really important through this process.
Well, Dr. Brooke Rossi, I want to thank you for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been great.
Dr. Brooke Rossi, she's a reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist at Ohio Reproductive Medicine. We've been talking about in vitro fertilization today. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay tuned. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The authors of a new paper in a peer-reviewed journal argue that there isn't enough data to support the very common recommendation to avoid red meat. Joining us is cardiologist at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, Dr. Raghavendra Baliga. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
What is your reaction to this data issue?
I'm cautious about the results. I think the authors of the series of papers in the Annals of Internal Medicine make it a point that there's not enough robust clinical trials suggesting that red meat is deleterious for cancer or for heart disease. However, even their own series of papers, they acknowledge that to say that there is no link is low or very low level of evidence. So even their recommendations. So I think to put it in brief, we don't have high quality data to say that red meat is deleterious for us to consume. And we need more data.
And you agree with that?
I agree with it because most of the studies were done by observational studies.
Okay.
There are several confounders. Plus, many of the subjects studied self-reported what they ate, so it was not precise.
Okay.
And the authors of the series of papers suggest that there was conflicts of interest. Having said that, I don't completely agree with the authors. I think the truth may be somewhere in the middle. And as you know, we can't pick one thing in our diet and say it's good or bad. It's the whole package.
It's usually a lifestyle.
It's a lifestyle, yeah. Exactly. It's what you eat. It's how much you exercise. And we don't know which kind of red meat it is, whether it's lamb or beef. So it's kind of difficult to put a finger on one thing in your lifestyle. It's the whole package.
Joining us is Dr. Stephen Clinton. He's a physician scientist specializing in nutrition and lifestyle at the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center, Arthur G. James Cancer Hospital, and Richard J. Soloff Research Institute. Welcome, Dr. Clinton.
Great to be here.
What do you make of this data issue? They're saying that there's not enough data to support recommendations to avoid red meat.
Yeah, I don't even consider it a data issue because the data they interpreted is basically the same data that's been out there for years and reviewed by very rigorous approaches by the Dietary Guidelines for America Committee, the World Health Organization, the World Cancer Research Foundation, and all of them have come to similar conclusions that dietary patterns that are rich in red meat or processed meat are associated with a modest, and I'm going to talk, I can't speak for the cardiology literature, but I'll talk about the cancer part, a modest increase in risk for several cancers. And really the key here is this, it's using the right tool. And what this group has done is reviewed data that's already out there, and they took an approach that would be far better applied to clinical research of a drug, where you can do really clean studies, randomized, double-blinded trials, and applied those criteria to food and nutrition, which is exceptionally complex, because we can't do a 20-year study of eating 20 ounces of red meat versus not eating any red meat and look at the outcome. So we will never be able to have that kind of data to support conclusions. So we have to use other tools to assess these risks.
Well, dumb question before you go on is, why can't you do a 20-year study? If they can study drugs or all the other stuff they study out there, why can't they study red meat?
Well, because look, if there's a new drug and we want to do a trial and take 500 people and put half of them on a placebo and half on a drug, and nobody knows what you're on, it's not that hard to take a pill.
Okay.
But if I were to take, you might need 20,000 people to do a study of red meat and divide them into two groups. Look how hard it is in the world we live in to say, for 20 years, I'm not going to eat red meat.
Yeah.
You see
okay.
what I mean?
Enough said.
this is difficult because everybody has to eat. And we eat a very diverse diet composed of hundreds of different foods. And each of those foods contains thousands of different substances. So studying diet and nutrition needs different tools than studying drugs. And I think this group doesn't seem to appreciate that you have to apply the right tool to the right job to get the right answer.
So, Dr. Baliga, why? What is the bottom line for you as a cardiologist when it comes to red meat? I mean, why do science and health organizations associated with heart health recommend a limited red meat diet?
And I think the mainstream recommendation is to limit red meat. And For everybody.
Yes.
And because most of the studies reported so far show a strong association between red meat and heart disease. And as Dr. Clinton said, this is as good as the data gets. And we have to go by what the data we have.
Have there been, Dr. Clinton, an evidence that as there are more obese people than ever these days, but that association or the correlation between red meat, does it improve the outcomes for people with cancer, for instance?
Well, that's a wonderful question. So now so far we've been talking about a public health message, meaning what is the recommendation for the nation or the population as a whole, which is to moderate your intake of red meat. And we should talk about what that means maybe later. But let me just say that once you start talking about what should a cancer patient eat or a survivor of cancer, now we're talking about maybe providing a prescription for an individual, which is a different context. And I would say that many patients and I have some in my clinic who finish cancer therapy and maybe are anemic and they are recovering and they've been through a lot of stress and maybe malnutrition associated with therapy. In that case, I may want a diet that is richer in protein, has good sources of bioavailable iron and other nutrients. And in a cancer survivor who's recovering, they may find that meat is a good source of some of those key nutrients to help them recover. But then we have that question, if you're cured and you have long-term life expectancy, what's the optimal plan for that person long term? And that would require a really nice discussion with a dietitian to work with that individual on a personal basis.
And Dr. Baliga, what do you think?
For
somebody with a heart condition.
Yeah, I still go by the mainstream recommendation about no more than 1 to 2 servings of red meat. And that's what I would...
Per
week.
Per week, okay.
Yeah. And most Americans eat 2 servings of red meat a day. And an average...
Really?
And an average... Not most. Many Americans eat. And an average American eats 4.5 servings a week. And each serving is about 30 ounces. That's about the size of our palm.
Uh-huh.
And
which is more than you need.
Yeah. And I think we do need protein. And I'm still leaning towards eating poultry and white meat rather than red meat. And, of course, this study is thought-provoking. And I think the truth may be in the middle, but we'll never know.
You know, we talk about studies a lot on this show, Dr. Clinton, and are you frustrated by that?
Well,
that every time there's a new study out, particularly with social media, it gets, how much control would you like to have?
Sure. I mean, I don't think we ever want to control news, but we want to try to convey the best information we can. And I think, let's just put this into perspective of tobacco and cancer. You know, here was something we observed in observational studies, just like what we're talking about here with meat. And we never, for ethical reasons, would have done a randomized trial of smoking versus not smoking to see if it caused cancer. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, tobacco might be a 20-fold or risk factor or 2,000% risk for getting a new cancer. When we're talking about the meat risk, we're talking about maybe increasing your risk of a cancer by 10 or 15%. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So meat should not be put in that same category as tobacco, but it's one part of an entire dietary pattern that you would want to address if you truly want to maximize your chance of reducing cancer risk.
If many Americans are having 2 or more helpings of red meat a day, as Dr. Baliga mentioned, that's a sign of a big problem, is it not? It's a red flag.
Well, so I guess I look at the numbers as, again, I'd have to go back and see what the servings are per day, but what a size of the serving is. So in my mind, the upper half of America is over 18 ounces a week, and the lower half is under. So I think 18 is about the average. So the real thing is that the increased risk kind of comes in that upper half. And can those that are really eating more than 18 ounces choose a healthier dietary pattern and get under that range? Does that make sense?
Yeah. And then, Dr. Baliga, it's also what they're eating with the
exactly.
meat.
I think we pick on only one,
yeah,
one aspect
usually,
of the diet.
Like we
it's
said,
the
a
whole
lifestyle.
Package.
Yeah.
It's about how much exercise you do, what's your lifestyle. And, you know, for a while, many years ago, they said carbs was okay. Now we know carbs is not good. I think at the end of the day, as far as nutrition is, it's the eat less food approach to diet.
Eat less food.
Yeah.
Well, let's have a little, not a debate, but let me just say, it isn't just eat less. It's what you want to do is maintain
sure.
a healthy weight.
Sure.
And
okay.
you do that by the amount of food and the amount of calories you burn. And so you need to find that right balance for each person. But even if you're at a healthy weight, the real key here is to follow a healthy pattern, which is very well defined in Dietary Guidelines for America. If you go to their website, it's a healthy pattern that you want. And it isn't going to be, we shouldn't be picking on just one thing all the time and trying to define this in great minutiae. The whole pattern is going to be more impactful than any one factor.
Well, that's why I try to avoid talking about diets per se, you know, the keto, the this and the that kind of a thing. But it seems like the pattern in the U.S. is people start out very young eating burgers and fries in this country. Dr. Clinton, and I'm
I will say that I use the word quite frequently that in the United States we have a toxic food environment, meaning we have the potential to eat very poorly, and many people do because of a lot of pressures that are on people and their family. Rush, rush, rush. No time to cook and shop. And if you are in a social and economic group that suffers disparities, I mean, you can be in parts of Columbus where you'll pass 50 fast food restaurants before you can ever find a grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
So we live in an environment with an advertising approach and a built structure that is making it very hard for many people who lack the education and knowledge to eat healthy.
These are socioeconomic issues, are they not, Dr. Baliga?
I agree. And of course, you know, most of my recommendations comes from trying to get people to be at an ideal body weight. And I usually recommend to my patients, they already have heart disease, is to eat like a horse for breakfast, a puppy for lunch, and a birdie for dinner. So you have the lightest meal at night. You're going to sleep at night. You don't need that many calories. But in the day, you're up and about.
There are so many ways that what we eat affect our health. And I know that because I have dermatological issues, and what I eat is directly related to the outcomes for me. But a physician, Dr. Clinton, never told me that. Of all the dermatologists I've ever seen, they've never said a word to me about it. Do we have a problematic disconnect? I know we have a disconnect between diet and healthcare in this country, but is it a problematic one?
Well, there are several questions within that question.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just start with the dermatologic question.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is no doubt that there are things in foods, man-made or natural, that can impact dermatologic conditions, but it is exceptionally complicated. And the reason it's hard for a dermatologist to tell you what to do is that there's not a lot of data. But individuals sometimes figure it out on their own based on, boy, when I ate such and such, the next day I have a rash. And, you know, each person then has to follow what they've learned. Now, this bigger question of do we have a problem about the medical system integrating nutrition into healthcare? We have a huge problem.
I agree.
And that huge problem is that we don't respect the knowledge that are found in the discipline of registered dietitians, who are the people who are trained to help us in clinic. We don't have them fully integrated into our clinical space. And often we run into obstacles where the insurance is not paying for the adequate amount of consult time that you need with a dietitian to truly help a person make the changes they need to make.
Hmm. And Dr. Baliga, what do you think?
I couldn't agree more with Dr. Clinton. I think our healthcare system is geared towards treating a patient rather than prevention. And so lifestyle, whether it's diet or exercise, the exercise physiologists, the dietitians, the nutritionists, I can't send my patients to them because it's not reimbursed.
Right.
And I think this is a great opportunity for our healthcare system to sort of involve them in patient care.
And when it's not reimbursed, it also sends the implied message that it doesn't matter.
Well, it is hard to lose weight. I mean,
yeah.
Our family members struggle with it. It's not easy. I mean, it's easier for me to say eat less. It requires a village to lose weight. It requires the whole family. It's not one person.
Mm-hmm. Physicians just don't have the time in the current healthcare system in this country to work with patients to achieve lifestyle goals. We have to use those who are trained in that field to help us in the same way we use occupational therapists and physical therapists. We need to make sure that the dietitians are reimbursed for the work and the knowledge that they have in order to look at these long-term goals for people. And it really takes a personal interaction to take each individual and understand what are their barriers to success in making changes and have that guide, you know, a captain of that ship helping you make the right choices, to make the right food selections in order to eat healthy.
Dr. Stephen Clinton, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Privileged to be here.
Dr. Stephen Clinton is a physician scientist. He specializes in nutrition and lifestyle at The Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Raghavendra Baliga, thanks to you as well. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
A cardiologist, Dr. Raghavendra Baliga is a cardiologist at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.